Hello and welcome again to another episode of Sacktown Chat Talks. Your host, Jarrett Blanion, today joined by Bill Wong. Bill, how's it going? Thanks for joining the program.
It's going good. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of been a weird, you know, 13, 14 months now in the world. Can you give us a little update on kind of what you've been working on the past 14 months?
Well, you know, just retooling for the next campaign season as usual, getting ready for, you know, a lot of districts to be different than they were before. Hopefully not too different, but, you know, for the members of the Democratic Caucus on the Assembly side, I think a lot of people, you know, just waiting to see what's going to happen with their districts. With the delays in the census, it's caused a lot of concern about it. Right. But there's nothing we can do other than just make sure that our, you know, campaign plans are ready, that, you know, our infrastructure is ready, and, you know, we have the resources to communicate with whichever voters end up being in a district.
Yeah. You know, the most interesting thing I've found since, you know, I've gotten in this business is there's so many different aspects of, you know, what goes on here in Sacramento. Can you kind of give our listeners who don't know you and know your background kind of a little bit background about you and how you got kind of in the working with campaigns?
Well, first of all, I was really bad at math. So engineering career was not my path in college. I ended up taking a internship with the state Senate in the late 80s. That's how long I've been doing this. And then from there, I just got involved in, you know, public service and then campaigns through, you know, working through different offices. And then now I'm the political director for the Assembly Democrats and an advisor to the Speaker Rendon. And then I do, in the intervening years, I've done a ton of stuff with Asian communities. I worked for Judy Chu when she was in the state assembly. I've done a lot of work with the API caucus in the various different iterations of it over the years, try to help grow the number of Asian Pacific Islanders in the state legislature, which now is a historic high.
Yeah. Can you like kind of take us back to when you first started working in the Senate? How many API members, you know, were there back then in comparison to kind of today? And how has that grown over time?
Oh my God. When I started in 1988, there were no Asians in the legislature, in the state legislature serving at that time. In fact, there had not been for a period of 13 years since there was a member from the East Bay that was in the late 70s after March Fong Yu got elected to the Secretary of State's office. It had been between that person whose name I can't remember right now, and then now Takasugi, who got elected from Oxnard to the state assembly. So that was a 13-year period where no Asian American had served in the state legislature. And then now I think there's 14 or 16 of them.
Wow. So what was the first year, I guess, an Asian American elected official was elected here in California?
That was Al Song. And I think that was like in the 1960s or something like that. There were three in the 60s. And then there was like this huge gap, and then there was another huge gap.
Yeah. I remember when, you know, I worked in the assembly in 2003, and I think at that time you had like Alan Nakanishi, you know, you had a Leland Yee, and it was kind of always an interesting, you know, the partisanship of kind of the API politicians. And you're seeing that now, right now where you have kind of conservatives and, you know, a lot more Democratic members kind of, I guess, is the political affiliation of kind of API voters. Is that something that's, you know, set its own or fluid, or is that becoming more defined, you know, today than it was 20 years ago?
It's fluid. I mean, for the longest time, it was almost a third, with a slight advantage to the Democrats and slight advantage to the no party preferences. In the recent years, some of that has changed, a little bit, but there's still pockets of the community that are Republican. You know, Vietnamese in Orange County are pretty strongly Republican. There are certain pockets of, you know, the Korean American population that are fairly strong Republican bastions. A lot of it is religious. There's a very strong religious following for the Korean American community. So those types of values drive a lot of the politics.
You know, I remember when I first met you about, you know, 10 years ago when Speaker Rendon was just elected and you were working for him. And, you know, there was this talk about, you know, who was the next speaker going to be? And, you know, Mr. Rendon's name was always floated around there as a hopeful. Can you kind of, I could kind of bring us back to that time and when, you know, Anthony was looking to become the speaker and kind of, you know, what work it took to, you know, become speaker from, you know, a freshman legislator?
It's always a little bit different. And I think that it was a lot different that cycle because he was part of the class that was the first class of 12-year
right.
members. So I think the stakes were high and there were a lot of new members that had never been through a speakership fight before. The numbers were higher. So this was really challenging. So I don't know if there's ever really a formula for it. I think the worst thing that anybody could have approach to a speakership fight is to rely on a formula. Like they want to use the, and you're a student of history, that they want to use the Willie Brown, strategy to speakership. It's always these types of things where you're always dealing with a different set of personalities and person and priorities. So the caucus is always changing. I think, one of the interesting things is that I was around when Fabian Nunez was running against Jenny Oropeza for speaker, and I had worked for Judy Chu at the time. And the history was that Fabian Nunez actually was the political director of independent expenditure against Judy Chu when she ran in 2001 for the state assembly. So she was an undecided during the speakership fight. And they had reconciled at some point in time. And then she ended up being a critical vote for his speakership. And, as history proved, she became, appropriations chair under Fabian Nunez. Right. Everything is really different. Like Willie Brown says, all you need to do is count to 41, right. that's the only skill you need. And, there's no formula or set pattern for it because every caucus is different. And as new members come in, the dynamics are all going to be different.
Right. Can you kind of speak to, when you first started, how many Democratic members were there when Speaker Rendon first took over? And what was that, 2014?
2014. We had just lost the supermajority because the voter turnout in 2014 was, really horrible. I think somewhere around 100,000 voters didn't show up in 2014. That was a cycle where the governor's race was not very exciting. Right. Nobody had any reason to turn out. We had lost Sharon Quirk-Silva and Almer Tsuchi, I think one more, another seat. And we were down to, I think, 52 members. So, and then in 2016, we brought back Quirk-Silva and Murasuchi, and then we picked up Sabrina Cervantes, so went back up to 55. And then in 2018, we picked up another five, and then Brian Mainshine decided to change parties, so we're at 61. And then this last cycle, Christy Smith decided to run for Congress, and we didn't really contest the assembly seat, so that was a Republican runoff, and now we're back to 60.
16. And kind of, I guess, can you kind of, what do you attribute, this growth and kind of the Democratic membership? What do you think is some of this kind of leading causes to, this growth we've seen?
Well, I definitely think, I can't really talk that much about 2016. I think that there was like a high turnout in 2016 just because of the presidential in California. But at the same time in 2018, I do feel like there was this huge reflex to the Trump victory for presidency in California. And, people were highly motivated in California to turn out the vote, even though we're not a swing, state. And there's a lot of organizations to, drive taking congressional seats as part of the strategy to blunt Trump's election. So we really benefited from outsized turnout in 2018. With regard to Democratic votes and no party preference voters voting Democrat, and even some Republicans at that time, one of the most interesting races was Cadi Petrie-Norris's race. She was at a +7 Republican seat. Wow. And she ended up winning by, 3 or 4 points in that seat. Now the seat is more Democratic for sure, but a lot of Republicans crossed over in 2018 to vote for Cadi Petrie-Norris.
Yeah, that's interesting. You kind of touched upon this. We just had the census and redistricting is upon us. Do you have any sense about how these districts are going to change or to what advantage they might turn to the Democratic Party at all?
I don't. I know that, you know, the biggest concern is the census undercount and how that's going to affect a lot of the districts. Some districts will have to grow geographically in order to have enough people in them to be equivalent to all the other districts. For those who are not familiar, basically whatever the statewide population is, you divide it by, you know, roughly 80, and then those are your 80 seats based upon, you know, the overall population divided into that. And then you have some margin of error, but basically right now, some of the seats have way too many people and some of the seats have way too little. So all that equalization has to occur. A lot of that, from what I understand, is probably going to happen in the Los Angeles region, Southern California region, because of the undercount in Los Angeles. And that ends up being kind of a gravitational shift that either pulls or pushes districts and reshapes them. So we'll just have to wait and see what the census count is.
And that will be out, what, in December, we think?
No, we're supposed to get the commission is supposed to get census data relatively soon. I think in the next 30 to 60 days. And then they'll start the process of trying to crunch the numbers. We, from what I understand, is that there's supposed to be some type of attempt to get maps by January or February, but okay. That's all in flux right now.
So, you know, working in campaigns and kind of not knowing how the districts are going to look for a June primary, kind of, you know, how are you able to kind of, you know, do your job and kind of work with candidates when they don't exactly know what their district's going to look like?
That's hard. I mean, it's almost three times as hard, because in some cases you have to plan for three different potential scenarios. So you have to kind of just make up scenarios and be prepared for all three. If, you know, then whenever the one scenario or what comes closest to it becomes the real district, then you have to run it. So we just have to be very nimble. But there's a lot of stuff that we can do in the meantime to prepare. One of the things that does not really affect districts is how much money we raise. So obviously all of our incumbent candidates are working very hard to raise the funds necessary to communicate with their voters.
Yeah. You know, something that's really, you know, turned up in the news the last, 30 to 60 days is kind of this rise of kind of anti-Asian violence going around in the country, but particularly here in California, especially, you know, the Bay Area and in Los Angeles, where, you know, there always have been large Asian communities. And, you know, it kind of rings a little odd to me that, you know, we're seeing this here in our home state. Kind of what are you attributing this to, you know, this kind of rise in, you know, anti-Asian hate crimes here locally?
Well, 40% of all nationally reported hate crimes have occurred in California. So I think part of it is because we have the population here. So a lot of it is more evident. And there's a lot more, it's what some people would call a target-rich environment. I think that the other thing is that what's driving it is 4 years of really extreme political rhetoric that has enabled and given a certain amount of consent to have racial divisions and act upon them, you know, with the incitement of Proud Boys, all the political language around it really encouraged the type of physical and verbal actions against Asian Americans, and that's all politically sponsored speech. I think a lot of people think that it's just organic, and maybe 30 years ago, if a politician said it and it got put in a newspaper, that's as far as it would go. But with the reach of social media now and with the advent of digital advertising, I don't know if a lot of people realize, but if you go to the Facebook ad library and you just type in Chinese, you'll see a ton of Republican partisan advertisements that use the China virus, rhetoric against China. And that is actually paid advertising that goes far and wide on social media platforms like Facebook. And that reaches a tremendous number of just regular human beings who then are programmed from a daily basis about this anger and frustration and resentment toward Chinese. And they cannot separate Chinese in China or the Chinese government from Chinese Americans, or for that matter, any Asian American. They just assume everybody's Chinese, which is something that we've seen in a lot of the media coverage, is that non-Chinese Asians are being called chinks and other types of derogatory terms linked to Chinese. And, you know, they all feel victimized at this point.
You know, I know there's a group called Stop AAPI Hate, and kind of they're tracking, I guess, the number of hate crimes occurring amongst Asian Americans this year. But I guess, do we have a sense of previous years, or, you know, is this a sharp rise, or are we just, you know, focusing on this more because it's, you know, as you said, social media and things of the like kind of bringing this to this our attention right now?
Well, we've always thought that it was underreported, but my understanding is that there's been 1,000% spike in the reports of Asian AAPI hate crimes. So it definitely has increased. I think that because of social media, there's been a lot more reporting of it than there has been in the past. Interestingly, when I first worked for Judy Chu in 2001, one of the first things that she asked Speaker Hertzberg to establish when she came into office was the Select Committee on Hate Crimes. And little did we know that 9/11 was going to occur, but immediately after 9/11, there was a lot of hate crimes against Sikh Americans because people thought that they were Muslim or Arab. And we had statewide hearings in order to educate the community, discuss issues with law enforcement, and come up with legislation to deal with hate crimes from those Select Committee hearings.
You know, it's been kind of interesting the past year, you know, with the George Floyd issue, the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, you saw corporate America, you know, nationwide kind of taking down brands and stereotypes that, you know, were deemed inappropriate. And kind of looking back now at kind of the Asian American community, there's a lot of stuff that's been going on, you know, the past, 50 years or so that people have just taken as normal or okay, that, you know, maybe it's not. What are you seeing right now and kind of, you know, raising the issue of kind of Asian American hate and kind of things that are appropriate or inappropriate towards kind of the Asian culture and people from an Asian background?
It's a turning point for the community for sure. I think that this time, this period is our 187 turning point. Similar to the Latino community when they're being vilified and the political rhetoric around immigrants and undocumented individuals from Latin America was so intense and also amplified by, you know, political ambitions and political agendas. You know, the community reacted very strongly to that, and that's what's led to their expansive political power in recent years. Was that reaction to the racism of 187 and anti-Latino rhetoric that was out there. So I think that the Asian American and Pacific Islander communities at the same point, there's a new, I think, awareness of being Asian American and Pacific Islander. Before, the community was very siloed or balkanized into sub-ethnic groups, but now there's a much broader overall AAPI identity that is starting to emerge. There is a growing interest and activism by the younger generation of AAPIs who do not subscribe to the same type of model minority behavior that was kind of ingrained in previous generations. So they're not afraid to stand up. They're not afraid to protest. They're not afraid to stand side by side with the BLM movement or with the Latino community on immigration issues and, you know, justice and fairness and those types of things. So, you know, we are at a turning point where I think that the AAPI community is going to become much more politically active than they've ever become in response to what they're seeing now.
Yeah, that's, I guess, an interesting thing I've noticed is you kind of, the Asian culture has always been reserved, has always assimilated in the past and has never given to kind of protests or, you know, even being that politically active. Kind of, what do you, I guess, you know, attribute, you've noticed that maybe it's younger generation, but I guess attributed to this kind of growing sentiment of, you know, having more of a voice?
I think it's the shocking nature of what's occurred and how we're now in a visual era. So they actually see these shocking things of grandmothers being beaten up on the sidewalk. And I don't think anybody can accept that as any type of, you know, behavior. So it really has shocked the community into a place that they've never been before.
Yeah, I think the most shocking thing was, you know, the grandmother actually beat the assailant up.
Yeah.
That was pretty wild.
But you don't mess with Chinese grandmothers. That's for
yeah,
sure.
I guess that's a good lesson to learn there. You know, coming out of that kind of, you know, that warrior mentality, you know, you've just started a project, Project Ronin. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about that and kind of how you came up with the name?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stuff being done in the community. And I think that a lot of it is great. A lot of it is nonprofit driven. A lot of it is airing of you know, grievances and history. But what I think is missing in that conversation is how politically driven this rhetoric is, and how it is a direct byproduct of a political agenda that is being funded and coordinated. So me and a lot of my colleagues who are in this space, who are Asian American or Pacific Islander, you really feel that there has to be a political answer to this. And we realize that most of the community is not necessarily there. Like you said, you know, there's a history of not being kind of dissenters or not being politically active. But there are a significant number of us who actually are in the profession. So we just said, we're not going to wait for permission from the community or try to bring them along, because they're just not necessarily there yet. But because we have the skills and the reach and the ability to, we're going to put together, you know, programs to make it make a political cost to those people who use this type of rhetoric against the community, and make sure that they understand that we're here to stay. Now, the word Ronin comes from a Japanese term. It's a term that describes a masterless samurai. And for fans of Akira Kurosawa, there was a movie called Seven Samurai, which the Magnificent Seven Western was based upon, where these masters of samurai, who are very well skilled, were recruited to protect a village from marauding bandits. And since most of me and my colleagues are bad Asians, and we're a little bit of a roguish group of people, mainly because we've heard disappointment to our parents for not being doctors or engineers,
right,
decided to use, you know, our superpowers, our political superpowers, to protect our village.
You know, that's one of the most tremendous things that you just kind of brought up. I remember going to an API caucus event, and you know, the members talking, and they all have, you know, wonderful credentials, you know, Dr. Pan, Harvard MD, you know, David Chu, Rob Bonta, you know, Yale, and, you know, Princeton, Harvard, on and on. And, you know, every one of them talks about how their parents, you know, wish they didn't become politicians.
Exactly.
Is there a changing sense, I guess, in recruiting candidates and kind of growing the API caucus? You know, you've done a tremendous job, what, now three statewide electeds. Kind of, is there challenges in I guess, finding candidates to run for office kind of in the API community?
There used to be, there isn't now. I mean, for example, in AD 49, which is currently the only Asian minority district out there, there's, I think, already four Asians running for that seat, and Ed Chow is not even out yet. You know, he's obviously applied for a judgeship, and if he gets appointed, it'll be an open seat. But I don't think that, in my experience, there has not been a difficulty finding Asian candidates.
Right.
And, you know, that's a tribute to the work of the API caucus and to API community groups that are interested in this space. They've really recruited and interested a lot of people in public service and running for office. Now, the question is, can we do more than just run Asians for office? Can we take out an elected official that is saying really horrible things about Asian Americans? In fact, my entry into politics was probably part of one of the grandest political retribution plans in the state, orchestrated by two Asian American women. I had come in an internship working for David Roberti, and at the time he had the Office of Asian Pacific Affairs. And I think it was Duke Majin, or must have been, I can't remember which governor it was, but they had nominated Dan Lundgren to replace Jesse Unruh as state treasurer.
Duke Majin, yeah.
So what most people didn't know was Dan Lundgren voted against redress for Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II. And the Japanese American community was incensed that the governor would nominate person who spoke out against redress for Japanese Americans who were interned unjustly during the war. So they organized a broad coalition of Asian Americans, African Americans, civil rights leaders, Latinos, to oppose the nomination of Dan Lundgren to serve as state treasurer. And they were successful in doing it. So that was the biggest political lesson to me, is that if you want people to respect you and to respect your community, you have to exact the political cost for the things they say and they do.
You know, it kind of seems to me that, you know, the Asian American community here in California is kind of like a sleeping giant. You know, they're a large part of our business community, you know, a large part of the voter coalition. Kind of, I guess, can you kind of speak to that? You know, what the potential is to kind of unwrap this community and get them engaged?
Well, I mean, they're the second largest ethnic minority voting bloc in the state. They have, they have approximately 2.3 million voters in California. Comparatively, Latinos have almost 6 million voters and African Americans have 800,000 voters. So when you're talking about, you know, voting power, they are a pretty significant voting bloc for anybody who's running statewide. And in certain districts, they're going to have a huge amount of impact. From what I've heard from various sources is that there may be multiple Asian minority districts that have to be drawn because of Section 2 Voting Rights Act requirements in the state. And currently we only have one. So, you know, there is going to be an expansion of Asian American Pacific Islander majority minority districts in the state of California.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you say, you know, Asian American, Asian Pacific Islander, it encompasses such a large area, you know, entire continent. I guess, are there difficulties uniting the group? And, you know, is that something recently that where, you know, all these kind of different nationalities and backgrounds have kind of come together to kind of work on issues?
It used to be a lot harder, but now I think because of, you know, the growth of the community, because of the current coalescing of an API identity, it's been a lot easier. And one of the things that we had a problem with before was there were significant differences culturally between the different sub-ethnic groups. But what you see now is you see a lot of this generation where they're the children of, say, a Vietnamese father and a Chinese mother, or a Filipino father and a Japanese mother. So now there's been this actual blending of the community. So there's these multi-ethnic Asian blended communities that are out there. And a lot of the cultural aspects are shared widely through popular culture, you know, through food and entertainment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for example, I listen to K-pop. I don't speak Korean, but I just enjoy the music. There's a lot of that's out there. Right. So there's a definitely a growing kind of broader identity, which then allows us to really move the community in one direction.
Yeah. My favorite, you know, is the Korean short rib tacos. That's the blending, you know, together, you know, this fusion has been awesome.
Yep.
You know, with the appointment of Rob Bonta as Attorney General, you know, that's a tremendous step up for the kind of the API community. Kind of is, I guess, there is any hope that he or the legislature can do anything to kind of stop, you know, this kind of Asian hate crimes or do anything to kind of, you know, put a stop to it?
Yeah, as far as I know, that there's actually 6 or 7 bills that have been introduced to address different aspects of it. I think that with Rob Bonta in the AG's office, one of the biggest problems we've always had historically is to find some consistent way of reporting hate crimes, because currently it's left up to individual jurisdictions on how they report and what they report as hate crimes. That's the problem that we had encountered in the past, was that there are a lot of things that occurred that weren't being reported as hate crimes, either because certain localities didn't have the resources to do it or just didn't think that it was important. So having some type of consistent manner and infrastructure to be able to identify and report hate crimes would be very helpful in understanding how to address the problem.
And I guess, is there any ongoing kind of study or database of these hate crimes so you can kind of see where they're occurring and if there's any sort of pattern or growth to them?
The only one that's really doing it now is the Stop AAPI Hate website. That's a combination of the Asia Pacific Planning Council and Chinese for Affirmative Action. And then I think the University of Chicago, you know, they actually created a website where people could go there and report, because otherwise a lot of times they're, you know, Asian American communities are not comfortable with reporting it to, you know, local law enforcement. They don't know how. There's language barriers. There's all these different types of factors that reduce the amount of reporting that's out there.
Yeah. Well, Bill, thank you for your time today. I know it's a busy time of year for you. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. I guess, is there anything else you want to get out there before you go?
No, I really appreciate you having me on and taking on this topic. This is a huge deal for the Asian American community. And the more we get out there and talk about it, the better things will get.
Yeah. And if our listeners want to check in on you or the Ronin Project on social media, can you kind of let us know how to find you?
Yeah, you just find Ronin Project at Ronin's United.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Bill, for joining us, and have a great day.
Cool, thank you.
All right, thanks, Bill.
Take care.